This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Overall, New Hampshire is a remarkably leafy, green place. In fact, it ranks second in the country in terms of the percentage of land covered by trees, a whopping 83%. And with so much of the state under that canopy, it'd be easy to think that, hey, the trees are plentiful and they're looking fine. But underneath the bark and lurking in the leaves are some threats, including a few you can barely see, invasive insects such as the emerald ash borer and the hemlock woolly adelgid. And that's a problem, not just because trees are pretty or provide welcome shade on a hot day. New Hampshire's forest cover also plays a key role in our tourism economy and in keeping our air and water clean. And so there are many Granite Staters who, like the Lorax, speak for the trees with efforts to protect them. Today in The Exchange, we see the forest and the trees. As we examine New Hampshire's forest cover, let's hear from you too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Scott Olinger. He's a professor of natural resources at UNH. And Scott, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Laura. It's good to be here.
Also with us, Ron Klimarczyk. He's a longtime consulting forester for communities throughout New Hampshire. He's also a wildland firefighter, serving as a special deputy forest fire warden. And Ron, as I understand, you just got back from fighting some forest fires in Quebec. So good to see you and welcome.
Thank you.
And also, before we jump into our conversation, gentlemen, I want to let everybody know several listeners already posted pictures of their favorite trees on our Facebook page, on our website. They are beautiful. So check them out and post a picture of your favorite tree there if you want, again, on our Facebook page and on our website. So, Scott, I'll turn to you first. How do we measure the value of trees today, and how has that changed?
Well, there's a number of ways to measure the value of trees. There's economic benefits that, you know, rate in the millions and millions of dollars when we think of the tourist industry and the recreation industry, but as well as clean water, the climate benefits of having forests in the state are almost immeasurable when you add all of them up. Probably the one that's the hardest to measure is just the aesthetic benefit, the cultural benefit of having a state with such a beautiful landscape with so much tree cover. And we can take that for granted, but I think it's important that we stop every now and again and make sure we really appreciate the resource that we have.
We used to measure it in pure sort of board feet, dollars and cents, right? Scott, I mean, talk a little bit about how the way we view the value of these trees has changed over the years.
Sure. Well, we still do that, and there still is an economic benefit of board feet. But there also are economic benefits having clean water. We have abundant clean water in New Hampshire. Forests are great at creating soils that are really nice water filters. That's something we take for granted if we had to provide water filtration facilities across the state and replace the role that forests serve. That would be hugely expensive. There also are climate benefits that we're not always aware of. In the summertime, forests keep the local climate much cooler through the transpiration of water. It's the same phenomenon that when our bodies sweat, we stay cooler. The forest is effectively sweating for the landscape, and it keeps our whole landscape cooler. And without that that benefit, there would be much higher electricity costs from air conditioning and so on and so forth. So we can actually measure economic benefits beyond board feet.
Wow. Sweating for for the landscape. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, that's an analogy. It's not exactly what they do, but we all know that plants need water. When water evaporates, it takes heat with it. And so forests transpire is the term for evaporation through plants. When forests evaporate water through their canopies, there are a lot of energy that otherwise would build up in the form of heat goes off to the atmosphere, and it keeps our local climate much cooler.
Well, and UNH research that I've looked at talks about environmental services from trees. So that's what you're talking about, Scott.
Exactly. That's one of the many environmental services that trees provide. Clean water, again, as I mentioned, is another one. They also are great air filters. You know, like many parts of the industrialized world, we have air pollution pollution. We have smog. That's a problem that's gotten better over the years, but we still have to worry about that. And trees are wonderful air filters, so we actually have much cleaner air than we would. If this landscape was completely denuded of forests, we would have not such clean water. Our air would be less healthy to breathe. Summertime would be much hotter than it currently is. So those are a lot of the benefits that we're not always aware of. Then there are other benefits we, of course, are aware of.
So one more question for you, Scott, on this, and then I definitely want to get your thoughts, Ron, as well. So everybody can probably imagine beautiful forests in the North Country providing all these environmental services that you talk about. What about sort of two trees on a busy city street in Nashua? I mean, are they providing those environmental services as well?
They sure are. And in fact, when you look at urban and suburban landscapes where tree cover is not quite as dense, the role of an individual tree becomes even more important.
I love your thoughts too, Ron, and that's kind of up your alley, you know, the urban forested landscape. How do you measure the value of trees?
Well, around houses, it's two things. Aesthetic value, you talk to any real estate agents, if you have trees in a yard, you know, healthy-looking trees, it becomes a part of the sales pitch on selling the house. And then the shade value, you know, we're talking about the evapotranspiration, cooling things, but just being in the shade, you know, as I work with the Boy Scouts and it's like, you know, we're talking about the values of trees. Where would you rather stand, in the hot parking lot or under a nice shady tree?
Pretty obvious.
So, you know, you get the cooling benefits from the shade also. One of the problems with the landscape trees, though, is the maintenance issues. Sometimes these, you know, people will be planting these trees in areas where they shouldn't be, under power lines or too close to houses, and can create issues. So although they do have the benefits, there is the maintenance issues that you don't have in a forest. You know, forest landscape, we can harvest the trees and, you know, set up timber sales or recreational uses. But in an urban landscape around houses along streets, you get the benefits, but there are some costs of the maintenance issues.
You know, and since you raised that, that's really interesting because not this past winter, but many, many winters in recent years, we've seen these big ice storms, and there's always, you know, big tree limbs that come down and they take the power lines down with them. And then there's always this hue and cry about, you know, we need to do a better job trimming our trees. And some people even say, let's cut down the trees. What are your thoughts there, Ron, as somebody who works in this field?
Again, people really like to look at trees, and when they start cutting back trees along power lines, it can be very unsightly. You know, suddenly there's this, you know, used to be a nice forested canopy along the street, and now they can see the wires. Yet when these trees come down, I mean, the people are the first to complain that, you know, hey, I've lost my electricity, the food's gone bad in the freezer, that type of thing. So again, it's kind of a strange situation where people really appreciate the trees, but they also like the amenities of having power and things. So when in newer landscapes, in new subdivisions, either they're putting power lines underground so people can plant trees, or in developments or landscapers come in, they're spending more time trying to figure out where to put the trees and try to get away from as we found out with the Emerald Ash Borer, there's been several developments in Concord that were planted all with ash, and now, you know, they're going to completely lose that landscape.
Oh, right. So all of a sudden,
We didn't learn our lessons from the Dutch elm disease, where people had the, you know, elm trees, you know, as in Keene was known as the Elm City, and they all, because they planted strictly elm, they lost all their elms at the same time. Now it's happening again. So this monoculture, we have to watch out for too.
So that's an argument, Ron, for planting a diverse forest, because if one tree goes, one species goes down, then you're in trouble. All of a sudden you're in the broad sunlight when you used to have a lot of nice shade.
Correct.
I'd love your answer to the question that I asked Scott. You know, everybody can probably imagine the health benefits, the environmental benefits of that big, beautiful forest in Cheshire County or up north. But what about that little tree, you know, again, on the city street in Nashua or Manchester or Portsmouth? I mean, what kind of human health benefit is that tree providing?
Well there is some, you know, again, the aesthetic appeal, but people get tied very emotionally to the trees in the yards. You know, they're sitting under the shade. To come up with an economic benefit, it's more the aesthetic, recreational type thing. And again, that's very hard to put a price on. And people will go to great lengths to try to save a tree, you know, rather than replacing it when they probably should have. So most of the areas near our town and city forests, when the land is being houses around it are being sold, you know, the big promo is, you know, next to conservation land. You know, your backyard will never be developed. So there's a lot of, you know, thought goes into saying, hey, you know, protecting the land behind us, you have a forest, again, for aesthetic reasons, you know, that type of thing that is really adds to the sales price of the property.
Well, it's so interesting what you say, too. And Scott, I'd love to hear from you on this. People get emotionally attached to their trees.
Well, I'm no exception. I learned just this morning from you that you have on your website a place where people can post photos of their favorite trees. I have a favorite tree, and it happens to be a tree in my own yard. I've been studying forests for several decades, but my very favorite tree, fortunately for me, is in my yard. It's a sugar maple that's about 6 feet in diameter.
Oh, you're lucky.
Which for anyone who knows something about sugar maple around here, that's an enormous tree. It's one of the largest trees in the state. Sadly, however, the dry summers that we've had in the past 5 years have been causing it to die back. And this summer, it broke my heart, but I actually had to call an arborist in to take some branches down that have died in the last couple of years. And I don't know at this point how much longer the tree will survive. We really need some moisture. But there definitely is that emotional attachment. I also would like to just follow up on something Ron said, which I think is really important, about the difficulty of quantifying economic benefits of city trees. Often we don't even think to do that until the trees are either stressed or have been lost. In the city of Worcester, Massachusetts, some listeners might know that there has been an outbreak of an insect called the Asian longhorn beetle. And that has caused the removal of hundreds of thousands of trees throughout the city of Worcester. And a study recently done on the economic benefits of street trees in Worcester came up with a figure of about $2.5 million per year of the combined benefits of the energy savings because of that cooling effect, the stormwater benefits, property value benefits, so on and so forth. When you add them all up, the economic value is about $2.5 million a year for that city.
Well, and that's interesting because I don't think of Worcester as a particularly leafy green place.
No.
So the few trees that they do have there seem to provide great benefit.
Yeah, and that underscores the point of when we have something in as abundance as we do trees in New Hampshire, we tend to take it for granted. But when you have fewer and fewer of them, they become increasingly precious. And in a city like Worcester, which was not that leafy green to begin with, when you lose the remaining trees, you really start to suffer the consequences.
Wow. Well, again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we are looking at protecting New Hampshire's trees from the backyard to the wide open wilderness. We're finding out about efforts being made to protect our state's trees from a myriad of threats, and we'll talk about those in just a minute, some of the invasive insects and the drought that we've been having. We'll also find out, though, about work being done across the state to keep our tree population healthy and thriving. The exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Whether you want to tell us about your favorite forest or your favorite tree or talk broadly about Granite State Trees and Forests, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And again, several listeners have already posted pictures of their favorite trees on our Facebook page, on our website. They're beautiful. Check them out. Post a picture of your favorite tree. And apologies, I did not remember to post over the weekend my favorite tree, so I will do so as well. You can join us with your questions and comments now for our guests at 1-800-892-6477. So, guys, both of you talked about, again, the importance of trees, not just emotional and aesthetic, but all the money that you save from not having to cool your home, to cool your community because of forest cover, air filtration, water filtration, and so forth. To you first, Ron, I think, how much do you think conservation efforts here in New Hampshire have focused on large forests versus the smaller plot of trees, you know, here and there in cities and suburbs?
It depends on the state has got a variety of terrain. You have the White Mountains and the land north of that, which used to be the industrial forest for the paper company. And then the southern New Hampshire, which is becoming quickly developed. There, in the past, the effort has been on larger tracts. Large tracts of land are typically cheaper per acre to acquire or protect. And the wildlife habitat, the larger the tract of property, the more wildlife you're going to be protecting, the more variety of habitats. And I think, you know, they typically say 250 acres is a nice piece where you can get, breeding populations, sustaining wildlife populations on that particular tract. But as a southern part of the state becomes more developed, smaller parcels become very important. And I do a lot of work down in the Hampton Falls, Kingston area. And they have managed their city forests in, 10 to 40 acres, whereas up north, you're talking, 1,000-acre tracts for conservation. So it kind of depends on the population. So the larger the population, the more development there is, any tract becomes important. And then when I was growing up in Exeter, a very small tract of land to a little kid still looks like a big forest.
Absolutely,
and,
right.
And so if you look at it from different levels, whether wildlife or recreation, in the urban parks, where they have good hiking trails, loop trails, it doesn't have to be a large tract for the elderly or for the little kids to go out and enjoy the forest. But if you're looking for, the habit and the wildlife aspects, the industrial, economic, timber production, you do need the larger tracts. So depending on where you are in the state, depends on the size of the parcels that are being protected.
I wonder what you think, Scott, about sort of recognition by the state writ large, the conservation community, about the value of these smaller urban forests and suburban forests versus, those big, fabulous tracts up north.
Well, I think we're recognizing the value probably more as the landscape is changing and the southern part of the state is becoming more developed. And so those smaller parcels of land, the ones that we've been fortunate enough to be able to preserve, become increasingly valuable and precious, really. So people really end up appreciating them through the experience of having them and having some trails to walk around in near their home or near where they work, which otherwise might not be there.
On the other end of this, how much does it matter to someone, Scott, in Nashua or Manchester, if a huge chunk of forest is preserved in Whitefield or Milan? I mean, you might say, great, I hope to visit that someday. But does someone in the southern tier get the environmental benefits from a big chunk of land being preserved up north?
Well, they do benefit from that, whether they recognize the benefit or not. It's unclear, but I think really what we need is a combination of small tracts and large tracts. There are organizations like the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests that has tried to take more of a statewide view. And yes, it's nice to have individual tracts preserved, but it's also for the sake of wildlife corridors and, at a large landscape level, having continuous, even if you take a lot of small tracts and locate them in the right places to provide corridors for wildlife migration and things like that.
Go ahead, Ron. Yeah.
In addition to that, one of the reasons why the White Mountain National Forest was founded is because those mountains were being clear cut, which was causing some erosion problems, which was then silting up the Pemigewasset and Merrimack River, which was then causing issues with the water power in the mills in Manchester. So they got the industrial support to protect that land. Well, Manchester, the big cities, Manchester, Nashua, the Merrimack River flows through those cities. So they are getting some benefits from clean watersheds by cleaner water that is now coming down through their city. And at some point in time, I'm sure that these rivers will be tapped for drinking supply as the population increases.
Oh, see, that's interesting. Okay, so lots of big forests up north. Ron does help people in central and southern New Hampshire because they filter the water that comes down through the central part of the state. All right. After a short break, we will start taking your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. Also, in just a moment, I'm going to ask our guests about some of the invasive insects that are threatening our trees. So we'll find out more in just a moment. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's a look at state efforts to protect trees and forests. We want you to call in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Whether you want to ask about the health of a particular forest or your favorite tree, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And by the way, you can post a picture of your favorite tree on our Facebook page and on our website. Several listeners have already done so, so check them out. They are quite lovely. And then post your own favorite tree picture. You can give us a call now at 1-800-892-6477. And Scott Olinger and Ron Klimarczyk, let's go to our listeners now. And Robin's joining us from Wilton. Hi, Robin. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Yes. Thank you. You know, I just wanted to call because I feel that we are so fortunate in this state to have so many trees, to have such a lush habitat for such a variety of animals that I think that is the most important thing of the trees in our state.
So you're just feeling fortunate about this. Robin, did you have a particular question you wanted to ask our guests?
Well, yes. I would love to know if they feel that trees in any particular area. I live in the Monadnock region, and I'm wondering if trees in our particular area are, you know, are vulnerable to things that are happening with the insects moving into the state.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Robin. Thank you very much, because we should talk about that, guys. Lots of headlines this spring and summer about nasty insects. And Ron, I wonder what you're seeing. I know you've been working on this.
Well, right now, because we've had several warm winters, the hemlock willy adelgid is moving north, and it's coming up from the southern New Hampshire border.
I see.
So, that's going to have a major impact along the Massachusetts border in southwest New Hampshire, especially the southeast New Hampshire towards the coast where it's even warmer. And then the emerald ash borer, again, is also, although it was found here in Concord, it's also now found throughout Massachusetts, and it's moving its way north from Massachusetts and south from Concord. So those species will be declining. Ash is not a big percentage of the forest in that part of the state or in this part of the state. However, hemlock is, and that
in
will
the
have
Keene area.
Yes, and throughout southern New Hampshire, and that will have the biggest impact. And unfortunately, hemlock is a very critical tree for wildlife habitat for protecting it. It has stiff branches. It holds the snow up. So the snow underneath hemlock trees tends to be less, which allows the animals to move a little freely without using as much energy in the snows. It actually insulates. It tends to have a lower crown. The branches are closer to the ground, which kind of shelters the animals as opposed, allowing their heat to escape into a higher canopy. So unfortunately, that's going to have the biggest impact. And hemlock is not a real valuable timber tree, but for wildlife habitat, it's extremely critical.
Well, that's interesting. So if the hemlock willy adelgid does a number on our hemlock trees, then wildlife species suffer as well, such as like mice, rabbits.
Deer. A lot of deer wintering areas are in hemlock. And the larger, larger birds such as grouse, turkey, that type of thing that do need that cover in the wintertime.
Scott, I'd love to hear from you, too, on the question that Robin asks about various threats to trees.
Yeah, well, I think Ron just mentioned probably the biggest one in that area, which is the northward spread of the hemlock willy adelgid, which does have that threat to wildlife. In terrestrial systems, even in aquatic systems, where hemlock often grows along stream valleys. And when you lose hemlock, the stream water, actually, the temperatures rise to the point where the aquatic habitat is not as good for trout. So it's a threat to trout as well as some of the land animal species that Ron mentioned.
Wow. So hemlock provides an important water filtration or service.
Sure. It sure does. And the other thing that that Ron just touched on is the fact that it's spreading north because of the warm winters that we've had. I think more in my own research about climate change than invasive insects, but there's a connection between the two in that many of the insects that have invaded New Hampshire are limited by cold temperatures. A single cold day in the winter or a couple cold days can kill a whole population of hemlock willy adelgid, but as the winters are getting warmer and warmer, We've been seeing the hemlock woolly adelgid spread north. At this point, it's already up into parts of Belknap and Carroll County, so it's moving north.
So some of these species, Scott, we used to not see because we had reliably very cold winters.
That's right. The hemlock woolly adelgid was introduced into the United States, I believe, back in the 1950s down around Virginia, and had been spreading northward very rapidly. But when it reached the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border more than 10 years ago, it really started slowing down because it started encountering the cold winters that we have. But as Ron mentioned, we've not had so many cold winters in recent years, so it's ramping up and its northward spread is on the move again. So,
well, certainly it would have enjoyed this past winter, which was quite warm. We were talking the other day about, 68 degrees on Christmas Day. But the winter before, Scott, polar vortex and frigid and, I can't remember when I stopped shoveling that winter. So
that's right.
That winter didn't do enough?
Well, that winter was not good locally for the adelgid. That polar vortex effect was very isolated to the northeast. There were other parts of the region that were not quite as cold. But the past couple of winters that we've had really have allowed the spread to continue.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Robin, thank you for that question. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Join us as we look at the health of New Hampshire's forests and trees today in the exchange, and the environmental and economic benefits from those trees. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. By the way, you guys both mentioned the emerald ash borer. We have a picture of that on our website as well. It's nhpr.org/exchange. You can join us now, 1-800-892-6477. And David's in Concord. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for having me today.
Sure.
Something sparked my memory when one of your guests was talking about the maple tree in their backyard, that big maple tree. He said that it might be dying because of the hot summers that we have been having. And about a year and a half ago, I had brought to my attention a video online called "Back to Eden Gardening," and the guy's name is Paul Gauci. And he gardens, and he has all of his trees and his shrubs. He has a ground cover over everything, primarily of wood chips. And some areas he has a stone, but everything has a ground cover. And he claims that it is extremely beneficial to his garden, to his trees, to his shrubs, because it helps to hold in the moisture. It helps to create a good environment for bugs, beneficial bugs. And so I don't know if your guests have heard about this kind of new method of gardening and if it can help, if they think it can help, people's backyard trees.
Well, David, thank you so much. And as Scott said earlier, and Ron, people love their backyard trees, myself included. Ron, what do you know about this?
In the Northeast, we've been very fortunate that we tend to have a lot of water compared to other parts of the country, especially the Southwest and Northwest now.
So drought's not a familiar condition,
right?
For our trees.
And so we haven't had to address the issues.
Right.
And this summer, because it is getting dry, people are starting to look at the treatments and methods that people have used out west to conserve water. As far as to conserve the water, you still need the water to come from somewhere in the first place. So ground cover, keeping the soil temperatures cooler reduces the evaporation of the groundwater. That is an effective way. As far as large trees, though, they got such a large root system and they're a large canopy that is exposed to the sun. The ground cover probably wouldn't be that beneficial.
So it depends on how big the
correct
tree is.
For smaller plants and shrubs, it would be very
well.
Beneficial.
And this may be a really dumb question for a tree guy, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Obviously, you can't water a whole forest, but right. If I had a particular tree in my backyard that I'm just that I just love looking at every single day, does watering it help? I mean, you water your rose bush. Can you water a tree?
you would have to be an extensive watering system, but anytime it rains, the water is soaking down into the ground.
Sure.
And the less rain you have, the less water the tree is going to get. So if you have a well or don't mind paying a higher water bill, watering trees is helpful in this type of a situation, especially if they've been recently planted or they're under stress from some other issues. They've been damaged or the storm has damaged the crown or something like that.
Scott, you want to jump in?
Sure. One thing I would say is that I think David's comment is a good one in that the particular sugar maple tree I mentioned is growing in a field, and so it doesn't have the kind of ground cover that it would normally have in a forest with leaf litter or a thick forest floor. I've only lived in this house for a few years, so I didn't create the field. It's been an agricultural use probably since the 1700s. But having said that, I think trees that do grow in fields that don't have a lot of other trees around them are more vulnerable to water stress than trees that are growing in an intact forest. I've actually tried watering the tree.
The
huge tree. It takes a lot of water, and I'm a little reluctant to really give it as much as it would need because I have a private well. And so you have to weigh the benefits of watering your tree versus the risk of having your well go dry.
Wow, that's a hard
particularly during
choice
a drought.
To make. Right. Well, and so we've talked a lot about water and the important benefits, the important role that trees play in that, and also the stress that they're under because of drought. So here's a question for both of you. Scott, you first. We've heard a lot, and we've talked a lot on this show recently about water contamination in New Hampshire. People are worried about all sorts of chemicals in their water. Can we say, Scott, if we had more trees and less lawns, in our suburban developments especially, the threat of water contamination would be lessened?
Yes, we can say that. I can't speak to particular contaminants, across the board because there are many kinds of chemical contaminants that are kind of beyond my area of research. But certainly things like nitrate runoff into lakes and streams, which is a risk for water pollution, both for the aquatic system as well as for our drinking water, is much lower coming from forests than it is coming from lawns. That's one of the things I study is the nitrogen cycle in forests. And nitrogen pollution in particular is something that forests really help keep at bay. And when you lose the fraction of forest cover that we have, there's a direct effect on how much nitrate contamination we see going into surface water.
So why is it, Scott, when you drive around or walk around any suburban type development, you see these big giant lawns that don't have even sort of one or two or three trees in them? Why is that?
Well, I think that's partly because as a species, we like lawns. Lawns are good, too. I'm not completely anti-lawn. I like open space. I like sunshine. I don't always want to be in the woods, 24 hours a day. So there are also benefits of having lawns and having open space. So I don't mean to say that we should not have lawns. But I think people largely are just unaware of the impact that the lawns can have, especially when they apply fertilizer to their lawns or, try to take steps to increase the health of the lawn and not understand what effects that might have on surface waters.
Well, thank you again for that call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Up next, Joe in Keene. Hi, Joe. Thanks for calling in. You're on The Exchange.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Joe.
So I have a question. First of all, I live in Keene, which, makes me sort of an urban dweller. But Keene is known as the Elm City. We
yes,
have
it
a
is.
Lot of beautiful trees here, some of which we lost completely way back when we lost all the elms. Although we're still beyond city. My question is, as an urban dweller, what can I be doing to sort of assist? And that includes like lifestyle things. What can we be doing who live here in town or in small towns like this to, have a better impact on the health of our trees and the animals?
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Ron?
Well, one of the things I tell people is to really support land protection initiatives. I mean, there's the southwestern part of the city of Keene has seen a lot of sprawl in the last 20 years. A lot of that was farmland and it was no longer economical to farm. The real estate value became very high. So supporting land protection initiatives to protect the forest environment will help the surrounding area, the surrounding landscape. And then within this cities itself or towns itself, Quite often they have conservation commissions or tree open space committees or even the maintenance departments, highway departments will have a tree planting program. So supporting these programs, you know, and they do cost money to buy land to plant trees, to maintain the trees. And so a lot of times these are the first things that get cut out of the proposed budgets during town meeting. So if you can speak up in support of some of these programs, it will help get that ball rolling. In Hopkinton, they proposed that we could bond up to $5 million to protect open space back in 2003. So far, we've gone through about half of that and protected almost 1,000 acres. And then we have some of these land that we have acquired. We set up timber sales, which provides money for the Conservation Fund or Town Forest Fund, which allows us to acquire more open space or do trails or roadside trees and that type of thing. So it can be self-funding at times.
Well, and when we talk about sort of preserving open space, even if it's that little teeny, you know, tract in the middle of town, both of you guys talked about the importance of that. On the other hand, Scott, we do hear a lot about the need for workforce housing, you know, for your average Joe or Jane to be able to afford a condo or an apartment or a small house. So how do you balance that out? You know, the obvious need for trees, which you gentlemen have made clear, but the need for workforce housing.
Well, that's a balance that I think just as a society we have to strike, you know, through a discussion that's broader than this. What I would say, just to get back to Joe's question about what individual people can do, another thing people can do is just be aware of the virulence of the invasive insect pests that are spreading into the state. Learn how to identify them. There are a number of websites people can go to. One that I referred to quite a bit is nhbugs.org, which has information about a number of different insect pests. Know how to identify them. Be on the lookout for those pests. Report any sightings that you see. The other thing I think that individual people can do is write to their legislators and say this is a concern. It's not something that's high on the list of agenda items in Congress particularly, but certainly even at the state level. However, there are legislation actions that can be taken. There are some policies in place to try to prevent the infestation and the spread of invasive species from China and from other countries that they're coming in from, but they're either not enforced very well or they're not aggressive enough to begin with. So I think there's some augmentation that's needed just at the policy level that I think people could be aware of and try to encourage their legislators to pay attention to as well.
Well, and that nhbugs.org, we'll put a link on our website so if folks want to look at that. That's where we got the picture of the emerald ash borer, by the way. So I'm glad you mentioned that, Scott. So what do you do if you see an emerald ash borer or you see a hemlock woolly adelgid on a tree? I mean, do you squish it? Do you call, you know, UNH Cooperative Extension? What do you do?
I wouldn't squish it. I would capture it if you're suspicious of that you suspect it's an invasive species. Some of them have other non-invasive species that or native species that look similar enough that unless you're really confident that you know how to identify them, I would instead capture the bug and call someone at New Hampshire DES, Department of Environmental Services, or call someone at Cooperative Extension, make a positive identification, and if it's an infestation in an area that hasn't previously been reported, that would be really valuable information.
And then from there, they decide whether to, you know, go in and try and kill these bugs. Do they do it with insecticide? Do they have to cut down the whole forest?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways that the pests can be dealt with. Insecticides can be used, but typically only on a local level. It's not a practical solution.
On one tree in your backyard.
Yeah, there's a particular tree that you really want to save. On a broader level, cutting trees down and destroying the wood is probably the only really effective method. But even that has limited effectiveness because it's so hard to contain these pests once they spread.
Sure, they just skitter away probably once you cut the tree down. All right, we will talk more in just a moment and take a lot more of your questions and comments. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at protecting New Hampshire's trees and forests. We're looking at trees from the favorite one in your backyard to the wide open wilderness. We're finding out about efforts being made to protect our state's trees from a myriad of threats, finding out about what those threats are and the work being done across the state to keep our tree population healthy. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to call in with your questions or comments about the health of New Hampshire's forests and trees. And by the way, we asked listeners to post some pictures of their favorite trees around their communities. We've gotten some great responses. Post your own pictures or share a comment or question with us on our Facebook page or on Twitter or on our website. You can give us a call again right now at 1-800-892-6477. And Ron and Scott, just before the break, we were talking with our listeners about some of the pests that you guys are seeing on our trees. And Scott, I think you had one more thing that you wanted to say to our caller's question about what can I do, how can I help, and how can we combat these pests that are invading our trees, really?
Yeah, well, as far as what we can do, it's really a daunting task because sometimes once an invasive species has entered into the region that's not native to North America, it can be really hard to contain it. In some cases, it's probably impossible. The emerald ash borer, it's unlikely that we really are ever going to get rid of the emerald ash borer. In some cases, it can be more cost-effective to ramp up our efforts to prevent the new spread of new invasive species. And I think, you know, there are some that we've talked about, the emerald ash borer, the hemlock woolly adelgid. Including invasive diseases, there are currently something like 47 non-native invasive pests or diseases in New Hampshire forests alone. That's a lot. Nationwide, a new invasive pest arrives. Something like 2.5 per year arrives. And a lot of those are coming because of the global trade that we see. And a lot of those pests are coming in wood shipping crates. A real simple thing to do would be to support legislation that switches to non-solid wood packaging, basically pallets. Wood pallets that have solid blocks of wood in them can have wood-boring insects from whatever country those pallets are coming from.
Wow. So a ship from, you know, Indonesia comes into harbor and
exactly.
There's bugs hiding away from Indonesia and they get out and they creep up Massachusetts and New Hampshire and Maine, and the trees here have no natural protection against that bug
exactly.
from Indonesia or wherever.
Exactly.
Just and off of a ship.
That's how most of the wood-boring insects arrive in the country, in wood that has been imported from other countries, often in wood packaging. And there are very simple alternatives, like having pallets that are made with plywood instead of solid wood. When plywood is manufactured, any insects that are in the wood end up getting killed.
Again, our phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's an email from Margie in Littleton. She says, what is going on across the mountains in Franconia Notch? Margie says, there are swaths of dead and dying trees. Maybe it's fir wave, but it looks like hardwoods. Any thoughts, Ron, on that?
I haven't been up to the mountains to see what was going on. I do know that in years past, some of the severe thunderstorms, hailstorms, have caused some severe damage to the hardwood canopies. You know, actually, the hail chewed the leaves off. So I suspect that may be going on up there.
Oh, that's interesting. So if the canopy gets damaged by a super heavy rain or hail, then when it faces threats like drought or pests, it might normally be able to protect itself, sort of gather its resources. But when the canopy is hurt, it doesn't have that energy, so to speak.
Yep.
Do you want to jump in on that too, Scott, to Margie's question?
I would echo what Ron said. And also, I have not been up in that area, so I don't know, haven't seen firsthand the dieback that Margie's talking about. But I do know that there can be diebacks like that. It can be hard to pinpoint a specific cause, especially if it's really related to an interaction between things like drought or some invasive insect. Or in some cases, the invasive insects can be defoliating insects like gypsy moth caterpillar or other caterpillars that eat foliage.
Wow. We haven't even talked about those yet. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Thank you for the email, Margie. And here's Eric in Dalton. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hello. I live in a town that when I first moved here, they did not salt the roads. I live on a town road. But in the last maybe 10 or 15 years, they have salted the roads. And I have a number of sugar maples, maybe 3 or 4, that have died since they started salting the roads. And I'm wondering if that has any effect
that
species.
That is a great question and one I have often wondered about as well. Ron, what do you know?
Yeah, road salt does have an impact on maples. And quite often the maple trees along the roads are already under stress. You know, the roots are growing under the pavement.
Sure.
They may get bumped by the snowplow and things like that. But the maples, which tend to like water a little more than, say, like oak or ash, which have a little more resistance to salt, are very susceptible to salt damage. So that could be the cause.
How do you advise communities, Ron, who want to preserve the maples? Tourists like to come see them. We all like to see them in the fall. They provide all that water filtration benefits that you gentlemen have already talked about. But nobody wants to slip off the road and, you know, crash.
Yeah, I think most towns will err on the side of safety, and we'll try to keep the roads free of ice and snow. One of the reasons why the sugar maples line a lot of these old roads is not because they were very pretty trees, but back in the day, maple syrup and honey were the main source of sweeteners in early New Hampshire. And so they would plant the maples along these roads or in front of their houses because in the springtime they could just go tap them. It was very close access for tapping the trees for the maple sugar. So they're already in an area which is going to put them at risk for road salt. And a lot of these trees are getting old anyways. I mean, you know, trees are living things. You know, they get old, sick, and die just like any other living thing. So a lot of these trees that are roadside that were planted in the 1800s or the early 1900s are also reaching their maturity. And so they're under stress from that too and become more susceptible to road salt. But I think towns would rather have safer roads than pretty trees, you know, especially with school buses and things like that.
So that's interesting. So in the old days, if I'm a farmer, I'm going to plant my sugar maples along the road so I don't have to go tromping through the forest to get my maple syrup. But now those roads, which I'm sure were, you know, not paved in the old days. Now they're paved, they've got salt on them, and so that's extra stress for the trees. So, Scott, is there any option to keep the road safe without salt? I mean, there are other substances we could use to keep the roads not slippery, but also not damage the trees.
Well, I shouldn't sell myself as an expert in winter road maintenance because that I am definitely not. I think probably the best thing to do is just to try to use road salt as judiciously as possible and just use it where it's really necessary, but not broadcast it in ways where it's really in overabundance and really not, you know, beyond what we really need to keep the roads ice free.
Well, it's a great question, Eric. Thank you so much. And let's go to Helen in Newmarket. Hi, Helen. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for speaking to you. The comment about lawns, everybody does like open spaces and sunshine, but one of the reasons that a lot of these developments have these big lawns is it's economically much better, much easier for a developer to just plow down all the trees, have the open space, be able to move the heavy equipment and do the construction and build the houses. If they had to work around trees, it would be a much more difficult job. So therefore, it's just going to level and clean out the area, build the houses, and then, you know, plant a few small trees. It's just something that's easier and more economical.
You know, that's a really good point, Helen. What do you think, Scott? You know, you do see in these new developments big lawns, and then maybe there's a little skinny new tree that they've planted there. And you sometimes wonder, okay, how many old trees did they cut down to do that?
Right. Yeah, often I always love when I see a neighborhood called Stone Oaks Neighborhood, and they had to remove all the stone walls and cut down all the oak trees to build the neighborhood. I think Helen is right about that. Sometimes it's really just the path of least resistance to clear an area and open it up for development. As far as how to prevent that, I think that's really just part of the marketplace. It requires people being more aware of the benefits of leaving mature trees intact and looking for properties and saying, hey, I would really rather have this property. If you're in the process of developing land yourself to build a house, you might consider having some of the mature trees left rather than cutting them all down and planting a couple of new saplings.
Including at a time when people are deeply concerned about water contamination, especially also maybe reducing their electricity costs. They don't want to crank up the air conditioner day in and day out. Go ahead, Ron, you look like you want to jump in.
The other thing is that a lot of the easily developable land in the state has been developed. So now they're going into areas that have more slopes or rockier that were bypassed in the earlier days. And the building requirements, you know, the roads have to be a certain percent grade. You know, they can't be too steep. The septic requirements are a little different. People, if they have wells or septic systems, they need bigger lots. And on rougher terrain, you have to do a lot more site work. So that would be another reason why a lot of these trees are eliminated completely to do development.
Let's take another call. Thank you for that one, Helen. Cheryl's in Durham. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
Glad to talk to everyone this morning. I'm calling just to encourage folks that are listening that if they have questions about what is wrong with their trees or an insect, they find that UNH Cooperative Extension has staff as well as facilities that can help them identify what's wrong with their trees. I'm the director of the UNH Cooperative Extension Plant Diagnostic Lab, so people can send me their sick trees or sick plants, and we try and figure out what's wrong with them. And then every county has a Cooperative Extension forester that can help folks identify what's going on with their trees in their counties.
What sorts of questions are you getting from folks these days, Cheryl, about their beloved trees that don't seem to be in good shape?
Oh, well, in June we had a lot of questions about why all the white pines were losing their needles. We're getting questions right now in terms of some of the insect pests that are on. There's some gypsy moth foliation going on in different areas of the state. In the spring, late spring, we had a lot of questions about why trees had some dieback on branches, and a lot of that had to do with winter damage this winter, particularly because of that cold snap that we had in mid-February.
Right.
So a whole range of questions. This year, because of our dry weather, it's been a little bit unusual, so our disease pressure from fungi is a little bit less than what it's been in years past.
A little bit less because there's less fungi, because fungi like wet weather. So
that's
a plus,
exactly,
you would say,
right.
Cheryl.
Yep.
Well, overall, I mean, how often are you telling people, look, I can't help you and you're just going to have to kiss it goodbye? And or on the other hand, you know, how often are you able to say to people, look, if you do X, Y, and Z, you can save this tree?
I'd say probably about 90% of the time we can give people advice and recommendations that help them to save the trees. Every so often we've got something that's just gone too far, or there's some wood decay inside the tree, and it's best to take the tree down, particularly from a safety standpoint.
Okay. Well, actually, that's good news, Cheryl. So thank you very much for calling in and sharing that. We really appreciate it.
All right. You're welcome. Have a great day.
Take care. So maybe you can call UNH Cooperative Extension to save your tree.
I would definitely echo what Cheryl said. I'm glad she called, and I would encourage people to do just that.
Again, our phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And while you're at our website or on Facebook, of course, you can post a picture of your favorite tree. You can give us a call now at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go next to Amherst, where David's on the line. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to suggest that in some cases, public works departments may be one of the threats to trees. Many towns in New Hampshire can designate roads as scenic roads in order to protect trees and stone walls on those roads. Unless the planning board or the Board of Selectmen is on their toes, because it's part of the job of the public works department to clear and make safe, those trees are often endangered.
So public works departments as a threat to the trees, David?
Yes. In fact, I mean, it's part of their job, it's their mandate to make all their roads alike. That is, wide, safe, and smooth. But in many towns, scenic roads are different.
Yeah.
And they often have century-old pine, oak, and maples growing very close to the roadway. And it's precisely these trees that, understandably, the Department of Public Works would like to be gone.
Well, Dave, this is a good point, and boy, we could talk about this forever, but Ron, it's a tough question. I'm going to throw it to you anyway. There's a balance, isn't there? I mean, curvy roads are beautiful, and they've got beautiful old trees, but he's right. I mean, people do tend to die in car crashes on these sort of curvy, beautiful country roads.
Right, and it's the smoother you make the road, typically the faster people are going to drive on it. And if we have a lot of snow and they're trying to push the snowbanks back, you know, after, and there's no room if the trees are too close to the pavement. But I think what the caller was saying, that if more people would vote to get, you know, it has to be done at town meeting, at least in the towns, to designate these roads scenic roads, so that if there is any modifications to the road, there is a public hearing. So that is one way for the people to say, hey, wait a minute, we'd rather leave these trees and have this road wider and where people will be driving faster on. But quite often, if it's a scenic road and then a large development is proposed at the far end of it, which is going to greatly increase the traffic on that road, then you really have to look at the, you know, the aesthetic versus the safety issue.
Well, thank you for the call, David. And here's an email about a favorite tree. This is from Lisa. She says, my favorite tree is next to my porch and bedroom window. When I moved to the house 15 years ago, my neighbor, a logger, told me it was unique because it's really large for its type, a sugar plum tree. She attached a photo. Obviously, we can't see that on the radio, but you can go to our website and check it out. She says it's magical in the small white petals that fall like snow each spring from its delicate blossoms. Lisa in Holderness, thank you for that email about your favorite tree. And here's an email from Richard in Hopkinton. He says, talking about woodland tracks, a shout out to the efforts of private and public entities to retain the forested green belt to the west of Concord to include the John Wynant Park and the Diamond Hill Farm and Farm Tract, as well as the acreage around Turkey Pond, owned by St. Paul's School. He also says, by the way, his favorite trees are those in the stand of virgin white pines in Bradford. That's a shout out to some of the work that you have done, Ron. Again, you know, Concord, it's an urban area. It's not New York City, but it's urban. And yet there is this green belt around the city.
Yes. Concord, I think, is has 64 square miles of upland, of woodland there. And the city forest that the city owns itself is about, we own about, the city owns about 12% of that land. And then you add to it the privately owned land through conservation easements, which is protecting the farms, and, you know, farm and forest landscape. So, yeah, Concord and Hopkinton have seen, you know, the residents of those towns have really seen the value of protecting open space, and Concord is very lucky to have a population that supports that.
Well, Richard, thank you for the email, and thanks to everybody who posted pictures of their favorite trees on our Facebook page, on our website. And Scott Olinger, I think the next thing you do when you get back to the office is to post that beautiful tree that you told us about.
I sure will.
Thank you very much for being with us, Scott. It was good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Scott Olinger, professor of natural resources at UNH, and Ron Klimarczyk, longtime consulting forester for communities throughout New Hampshire. Ron, thank you also for being here.
Thank you very much.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.